This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. Operations at the West Virginia Schools for the Deaf and Blind have been shaky for years. Stemming from a less than satisfactory audit in 2010, the schools have since come under new leadership, had their location in Romney questioned, and now are struggling to maintain their buildings, some of which are more than 100 years old. The legislature approved two bills this past session to help the schools. As part of our occasional series, Effective from Passage, Ashton Barra details those bills, their eventual veto, and what the school's administration is doing now to keep its doors open.
To understand the legislation West Virginia lawmakers approved this year to aid the schools for the deaf and blind and their subsequent vetoes, you must first understand the schools themselves and their challenges. Situated on 79 acres in Hampshire County, the 145-year-old establishment serves as an education hub for both the deaf and blind communities in West Virginia. Many of the school's 120 pre-K through 12th grade students also live on campus during the week, traveling home to all corners of the state each weekend. As we walked the campus, Superintendent Dr. Lynn Boyer explained that's a fairly new decision.
And so we started calling other state schools, and we did not find one of them that kids stayed over the weekends anymore.
But in the past few years, Boyer has surveyed deaf and blind schools across the country about more than just their weekend travel schedules. She's also focused on how 48 states with similar schools fund them.
But we did sort of a dipstick kind of calling one day, and every school we called was funded either totally or very highly through their state legislature, much as we are. So what we realize is we're not the only one with this kind of funding stream.
But it's that funding stream that's posing challenges for the aging schools. While the West Virginia Schools for the Deaf and Blind reside in Hampshire County, they are not part of that county school system. In fact, they're not part of any county school system. The schools are overseen by the West Virginia Board of Education and funded fully by a line item in the state budget under the purview of the state legislature. Established in 1870, the campus houses 16 major buildings, but only about half of those are currently being used. There's a school for the blind, separate elementary and secondary schools for the deaf, a dormitory with a cafeteria, and others, but many have either become outdated or fallen into disrepair.
So this was their cafeteria. This was the cafeteria for the blind.
Boyer paused on our walking tour next to a beautiful brick building in the middle of the campus that had been used as a hospital during the Civil War.
After I got here, Brem came and looked at it and inspected it and said, "You can keep it open, but we won't insure it for you."
The building is now surrounded by bright orange plastic fencing to keep students and faculty at a safe distance. It was just one that would have been demolished under their comprehensive educational facilities plan that Boyer oversaw the writing of in 2012. That plan included condensing the campus, consolidating some of the schools in order to create a stronger sense of community. But that plan also came with a more than $80 million price tag.
And it was very startling to people to hear the number. It was a very high number of cost for the cost of those changes. But I think it was the first time that people really said, "Oh my goodness, we really have to take a look at the schools and see what they're doing and what do they intend to do and what role do they fill in our state and what is best for the kids."
But the startling number ultimately was too high for the state board to back. Instead, the CEFP was altered, bringing the total cost down to $42 million over the next 10 years. That includes things like updating housing, additional building security, and a fire alarm and sprinkler system suitable for the needs of both deaf and blind students and teachers. In order to meet those construction needs, Boyer went to her funding source, the state legislature. Two pieces of legislation were introduced in 2015 to help jumpstart the process. The first, an appropriation of one-time funds totaling $1.5 million.
We had suggested that that amount of money would be useful to begin the consolidation of the secondary and the elementary schools' buildings for the deaf.
The second bill changed state code to allow the schools to apply for West Virginia School Building Authority funding, a state agency that awards dollars to counties for school construction based on need. Both bills passed with overwhelming support, but when they reached the governor's desk, he refused his signature.
It was not expected that the governor would veto them. So that came as a surprise to all of us because support had been so universal.
In his veto message, Governor Tomlin wrote he did not feel the schools had a plan to become financially viable in the future and asked for an independent assessment of the schools. Since, the governor's office, State Board of Education, and Dr. Boyer have begun meeting, working to answer the governor's questions about viability and looking for answers to their financial needs. The group is still in the exploratory phase, as Boyer says, but each meeting, each phone call is a step forward.
There are not any obvious answers yet, but certainly I think in our conversations, we keep getting clarity from each other.
Possibilities for funding, Boyer says, include changes to the state code to allow the schools to participate in the state school aid funding formula. It calculates state dollars granted to a school system per pupil. Boyer says the schools are also hiring a grant writer and looking for private donors. But it will be up to someone else to follow through with all of the funding possibilities. Boyer announced her retirement late last month with plans to finish her tenure at the end of June. Boyer came in at a crucial time in the school's history, a time when the quality of education they were providing was being questioned. She was called on, she says, to make some major changes, and she's done that. But now she says it's time for someone else to fill that role.
There comes a time when a person who comes in that role to realize that you can step aside and others can carry it on. Because there's no way that change can be identified with only one person for long.
Her retirement wasn't influenced by the governor's position, Boyer says. In fact, she had been considering the change well before the legislative session even began. She says she intends to spend more time with her family, especially her two grandsons, who will graduate from high school next year. The West Virginia Board of Education will soon begin the search to fill Boyer's shoes. They're expected to discuss the progress of that search and the independent assessment during their monthly meeting Wednesday. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Ashton Mara in Romney.
And we'll stay in Romney for our next story. This is West Virginia Morning. It's 7:51. Partly sunny skies today. There is a chance of scattered rain and thunderstorms. Temperatures in the 80s to near 90 degrees. Rain and thunderstorms in the forecast tonight. Overnight lows in the 50s and 60s. Mostly sunny on Tuesday with a chance of scattered rain and thunderstorms. Much cooler with highs Wednesday in the 70s. A national nonprofit group that builds custom houses for severely wounded veterans broke ground Saturday on its first project in West Virginia. Homes for Our Troops will hand over the keys to Army Sergeant Doug Harris later this year in Romney. As Jesse Wright reports, the mortgage-free house will include hundreds of adaptations specially designed for Harris.
I was injured May 30th, 2012. Just stepped on an IED.
I first met Sergeant Doug Harris in early April at the opening of the Monongalia County Ballpark in Morgantown.
Resulted in the amputation of my right leg immediately. My arm was almost blown off, but luckily enough they were able to save it. And I lost my left leg a day later due to infections.
Harris sustained his injuries while on patrol in Afghanistan with the 520 Infantry 3rd Striker Brigade combat team. He spent 7 months recovering at Walter Reed Medical Center in Maryland. Doug met his fiance, Autumn Dieter, while he was rehabbing.
We started talking online, and then we decided to meet one day at Bob Evans, and since then, we just hit it off.
Doug and Autumn live in her grandparents' house in Cumberland, Maryland. But the house isn't big enough to accommodate a wheelchair. That makes it very hard for Doug to get around and do basic things that other people may take for granted, like laundry. That task is left completely to Autumn because the washer and dryer are on a separate floor.
You know, it's kind of one of those things where, I'd hate doing laundry, but I'm kind of looking forward to being able to at least have the option and the ability to go and do that.
While he was at Walter Reed, a wounded warrior advocate urged Doug to apply to the Homes for Our Troops program. The program works with veterans who were severely injured in combat during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Shelley Yarbrough is a board member for Homes for Our Troops.
It began basically as a general contractor up in Massachusetts seeing the need. Had a local veteran who was severely injured. He said, I'm going to build you a home, and the vet basically challenged him, said, I'm not going to take it unless you build another one, too.
Yarbrough was among the 100 or so people who came out Saturday for a groundbreaking ceremony at the Augusta Fire Hall outside Romney. She says Homes for Our Troops doesn't build just anywhere.
Homes for Our Troops listens to the vets and their families. Where is it that you need a home? Why do you need to be there? What is your objective? What will this home enable for you?
Yarbrough says once the veteran's needs and long-term goals are laid out, a location is picked that works for the veteran.
They go out of their way to try to find property in that local area because family infrastructure and support is so important for a vet to be able to continue to move on.
Homes for Our Troops has finished projects in 39 states, and Yarbrough says 90% of donations to the program go toward building costs. Each home is about 2,600 square feet with 4 bedrooms and 2 bathrooms on 1 level. There are about 150 special adaptations the veterans can choose from.
I've been in my house for about a year and a week.
Marine Corporal Brandon Rumba lives in Uniontown, Pennsylvania. Like Doug Harris, he's a double amputee who was wounded in Afghanistan. Brandon was in Romney on Saturday to meet Doug and offer his support. Before Homes for Our Troops built Brandon's home, he was in a 2-story rental. The bathroom wasn't big enough to fit his wheelchair, and the bedroom was on the second floor.
There's a lot of crawling around on the ground, and a lot of my time was spent figuring out how I was going to do things around the house.
Now Brandon says being in a house tailored to his needs has gotten rid of a lot of stress in his life.
You're able to focus on yourself more than anything and become independent.
Outside the fire hall, you could tell how much the community is taking an interest in Doug and Autumn.
This is Walter, and we are your neighbors over the ridge.
Over the ridge?
We're right over the ridge, yeah. Okay. We walked to your place this morning.
It's awesome. It's an awesome experience. I mean, when I enlisted, like, I didn't, you know, do it for, you know, the thank yous or anything like that. So, I mean, for somebody to come up to me that I never knew or anything like that, just, you know, it's shocking, but it's a really humbling and it's an awesome experience.
Doug's house should be finished by fall. He won't ever have to pay a mortgage or homeowner's insurance. Homes for Our Troops does put a 10-year lien on the property, though. Beginning in year 6 of the lien, Doug will begin accruing 20% equity in the home. He'll own it by year 10. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jesse Wright.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Keep up with all the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Ashton Mara. Our director is Teresa Wills. I'm Beth Voorhees.